again, despite the weather, we are sort of in the heart of wildfire season. And wanted to come at this conversation this week a little bit from the angle of, you know, how to prepare for that possible evacuation. And this stemming from wildfires that we saw kind of kicking off the season, so to speak, down in Ninilchik a couple of weeks ago. We saw a few evacuations down there. And I guess kind of wanted to get started in talking about wildland fires and the wildland fire season from that angle. And of course, throughout the next hour, we'd love to hear from you as well. 283-8414 is the number. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, again, 283-8414. And so, again, I guess in starting off, just to kind of look back a couple of weeks ago to what happened, I believe we're calling that the Bluff Drive fire down in Ninilchik. How did that go?
So the fire went well, and really that's an example of what we like to call a save, which is, you know, we didn't lose any homes. We thought we were. And that was definitely a good thing. But, you know, so what happens when we have a wildfire? So there's a little bit of legalese here we'll try and dispense with first up, is that the State Division of Forestry, located in Soldotna, has the responsibility for suppressing wildfires, for putting it out. But it's just not that simple. We work with forestry, all of the area fire departments, whether it's volunteer service areas or cities, work with forestry to suppress fires. So often what you'll see, and what we did see down at the Bluff Drive fire in Ninilchik, is forestry will kind of take the lead in commanding that and putting the fire out and suppressing it, where some of our departments, so we had, for instance, that fire, Ninilchik Emergency Services, as well as Anchor Point and Central Emergency, they might be assisting, whether that's with personnel or in this particular case, a very important one is what we call structural protection. So we'll actually have folks assigned to protect those structures. So the interesting thing about that fire, we did have to do a small evacuation. It was kind of what we call a no-notice fire. It just kind of happened, and it was close enough to a neighborhood that everybody took great quick action between the fire departments and the troopers and everyone else. But it's a partnership, really, and it is, it's very important to realize that not any one of us can do this alone. So we very much work together in a unified way.
You mentioned the state having some responsibility in the actual suppression of the fire, and then other duties sort of falling to other agencies as conditions sort of dictate. Maybe you could sort of explain what that hierarchy is, and I guess maybe if it's helpful for folks, just for a point of reference, and just for maybe my own help a little bit, going from a point of view of something like the Funny River Fire, the Card Street Fire, one of these sort of bigger ones that did impact a lot of neighborhoods, but we're still a little bit different in each one. But coming from that point of view where there's, you know, it's a pretty big deal, mm-hmm. right? Maybe you could talk a little bit about that hierarchy and how those decisions get made, sort of who's in charge and how that communication web sort of gets built.
Absolutely. And every fire is a little bit different, but we all follow the same structure. It's called ICS, the Incident Command System. It's a national system. But like I mentioned, forestry has that responsibility. And when you talk about some of those other larger fires that we've had in the past few years, Card Street or Funny River, forestry always starts that with what we call the initial attack. So they're the first ones out, along with the fire department that's responsible for that area. But that fire may grow in complexity to where we need what's called an incident management team. And so essentially forestry will turn the management over to an incident management team. And this is where maybe you'll see some folks from other parts of the state or from out of state, depending on the fire. So, for instance, Card Street, I believe our incident commander, our person in charge, was from out of state. So
Yeah. These
are highly qualified teams. Many of them, this is all they do. They simply go from one emergency to another, and they have a rotation. Where they're on call.
These are the yellow shirts and the green pants.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Yes. You get that. But they're really the folks you don't see often. You might
right.
see a few folks at a community meeting or a briefing or you know, talking to media. But what you're not seeing is really that whole apparatus behind them that supports it, because that ultimately supports those folks in the field that are actually doing the heavy work. So that's that forestry aspect is kind of how it starts. But these other agencies come in to support them. So whether that's that fire department, and then kind of over here off to the side, and sometimes depending on what the fire is, we may or may not have a role as the borough's Office of Emergency Management or a city, if it happens to be in mm-hmm. a city. It's usually not, but it's not unheard of. And we're responsible for essentially everything else. So we don't put out the fire, but when we're talking about evacuations now, things that about our residents and those types of services, that's where we come in. So we work with that commander, that incident management team, or whoever it is with forestry, to make sure that we know, you know, when are those milestones for when we might need to evacuate? When are people going to be in danger? What is the fire prediction looking like? And that, again, goes back to that support team that's back behind those folks.
And so in talking about that, you know, obviously there's a protocol. How does that work? What are some of those? Are there triggers that come along that, you know, you can sort of check down a list as a fire is responded to and you get a picture of what's going on and what the area looks like and what potential property and public safety things might be in the path of that fire? I'm sure that protocol kind of comes into focus. And so is that sort of like a checklist? Is that how it works in terms of it's a step-by-step process, kind of.
Yeah, it is. It's a little bit different for every fire, and so there's a little bit of a distinction here that I want to make between what we call a no-notice fire, which would be similar to what we just saw in Nanalchik, and that's where, again, the fire comes out in a residential area. We're threatening things immediately, and that decision is made by generally the first person on scene, whether that be forestry or the local fire department. That incident commander that we call them has the authority to say, we have this area threatened, we're going to evacuate it now, and then maybe we'll reassess here as we get some more folks on scene. When we deal with something that's what we call low notice, so a Funny River fire would be a perfect example of this. You know, this started out on the Funny River Horse Trail. We had lots of neighborhoods and very high value properties out in the Funny River area, way out Funny River Road. We end up basically putting in trigger points. So with the direction of the incident commander and as we plan together, those are usually time-based. So kind of the standard that we've done for this is typically at about what we, and they have fire behavior specialists, so they can kind of tell us, all right, this fire is maybe about 12 hours out from this residential neighborhood. That's when you're going to start hearing us say, get ready. If you've got pets, if you have special needs, maybe you need to go now. Mm-hmm. And then generally at 6 hours, that's when an evacuation order gets put out. But it can vary. So each team or each incident commander, we can look at the fire behavior and we might modify that. But that's a very good kind of standard baseline in which we start.
And this would be a good time to sort of divulge the ways in which those notices are communicated, because there are a lot of different ways. And for folks who have cell phones, that's a very popular and expeditious way to get that information.
It is. And so there's a couple different ways that we use, and all of them are equally important, because remember, our objective here is we want to reach the people that we want to reach. So, you know, the first thing everybody thinks about is their cell phone. And this is a great time to mention our KPB Alert system.
Right.
And that is basically an opt-in system. You can register your cell phone and you associate it with an address or addresses. So if you have multiple properties, that's fine. And we can basically geographically target some alerts for you. So if it is an evacuation, if it's something else, so we've used it, for instance, if we have maybe missing children or missing vulnerable adults, you might get messages. You know, things that are, we try to be very specific to geography, because we don't want to send an alert every day,
right,
you know,
right,
type of thing. But the other side of that is, you know, those systems are not infallible. So we start working on things like through television and radio, getting that out through local media, maybe using the emergency alert system, which is, you know, most of us can hear that test every so often here on the radio.
Sometimes it happens during this very program.
So we're familiar with that, but that is a system. There's another system out there that can broadcast to cell phones, but there's some highly technical issues with that. That's a federal system, and unfortunately, I only have the option of basically broadcasting that to the entire Kenai Peninsula. So very rarely would we say,
right,
do that to avoid causing confusion. So the take-home messages here, we're going to try and get things out via our alerting system, via media, and we may also, in a wildfire and in cooperation with forestry, establish things like our call center, where we have an information number that people can call. We might, it's called a trap line in the wildfire world, but we may simply have a point. It might be a school parking lot or the grocery store or a neighborhood store that we have a staffer maybe with a map that's getting that up-to-date information. So all of those things happen. When we go through an evacuation, we use all of that technology that we can. Now, technology doesn't always work. So some folks that were in some of the neighborhoods in Kenai a couple weeks ago, we actually practiced our final step, which is going door to door. And we'll use some of our staff, law enforcement, Alaska State Troopers or police officers, as well as our CERT program, our Community Emergency Response Team volunteers. And that's designed to be that final check. We want to make sure everybody got the message. Everybody knows if they're choosing to go, that they're going.
Mm-hmm.
So we use a very much a tiered system to get that information out. And the idea is that most of that happens at about the same time. But obviously that door-to-door logistical piece sometimes takes a little bit of time. And that's why it's designed to be the last step.
Has there, has there ever been an instance of mandatory evacuations?
So in Alaska, only the governor can do a mandatory evacuation, and so in a disaster setting. So there are, believe it or not, a fire department can do a mandatory evacuation or shut down a road or do some things. And there was some examples in some of those fires where some people didn't want to go, and it wasn't a, quote, mandatory evacuation, although I heard stories of people being carried out of their home,
mm-hmm.
you know, for life safety. That's not something we want to do a lot. But there is really not truly such a thing as a mandatory evacuation unless the governor says so. So everybody has a choice.
Right.
So we just want to make sure they get that choice and they understand the risks of it.
Well, and it's interesting, you know, from my perch as a reporter, covering these things is interesting because it's one of the few instances where you have there's almost a race to get information out. You know, so often as a reporter, it's digging to get information. But in a case like this, when public safety is a number one on the list, you have local, state, federal agencies, you know, tripping over themselves to try to get as much information out to as many people as possible. And yeah, there are a lot of ways to do that.
There's a lot of ways, and there's also a lot of misinformation, and that's something that we really deal with nowadays, more so because we have the social media aspect.
That seems like it can be a real double-edged sword, where on the one hand, yes, you can reach a lot of people with the click of a mouse, but on the other hand...
yeah, and it's generally not intentional, but what ends up happening is, you know, we kind of joke here. I just used this in a class I was teaching. You know, the old way of when we were managing any sort of incident was, you know, every two or three times a day, we'd send out a press release, you know, literally a piece of paper with an update, and we'd send that to folks like yourself and all the media, and that was how we did that. Well, the expectation is now, of course, we're not waiting two or three times a day. We're going to get everything out as quickly as we can. And what our challenge is the reason we don't often get information out very quickly initially, or we might not give much, is because we still have to make sure that information is verified. So it might go out to the Bluff Drive fire here as an example. You know, so we very quickly got on social media on some of our channels and put out, you know, this evacuation is in progress. There's a fire. You know, please be wary of emergency vehicles as they're responding. And that was pretty much all we said. And then naturally there were questions that got posted, which is fine. But the reason that's that initial response, that ramp up takes us time. So Bluff Drive, that fire was on a Saturday. We're not staffed, so we're on call. So we're rushing to get in. People are getting into the office. They're doing things from home, all those types of things. So it's important for us to get that verified information out, and that's why sometimes you don't see a lot from us in the beginning, but we also really watch to make sure that unverified or just plain incorrect information gets countered as well, because sometimes rumors happen, and now rumors are able to be magnified with a tweet or a Facebook post. So it is definitely a new challenge for us that we try and address.
Right, and much more important that first sort of burst of information that gets out there is accurate and confirmed than just out there immediately.
Exactly.
You know, if it takes a few extra minutes, but it's accurate, that's a better scenario.
It's a better scenario, but, you know, on the other hand, we recognize that our world is full of technology that supports that, and,
sure.
and where you can watch, you know, revolutions in countries on Twitter and live video. You know, some people ask, well, why can't you do things like that? Well, we're not quite set up for that yet, but we do want to get that out as quickly as we can. So what we kind of tell people is we're going to get you the accurate factual information, whether that's from the borough or whether that's from any one of our partner agencies like forestry or any of the fire departments. We're going to give you accurate checked things, and we're going to get out things that are needed for immediate public safety. It might take us a little bit to get how big it is or how it caused, and you know, some of those things are not the borough's responsibility.
Sure.
But again, one of our partners will get that out eventually, but it does take a little bit of time.
Yeah. Dan Nelson joining us on the Kenai Conversation this week. Of course, if you'd like to jump in on the conversation, we'd love to have you. 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414, talking about wildland fire season is upon us, despite this sort of cold, rainy weather that we're in the middle of. As we all know here on the Kenai Peninsula, that could change in a very short amount of time, and there could be smoke in the air, as we've seen in years past. And sometimes that smoke means that it's time to get out, and that's what we've been talking about a little bit here today. I wanted to get into a little bit of that, the preparatory nature of this, because as you mentioned, there's no notice when it's time to sort of bug out, and then there's low notice. But the no notice part is the one that that's where a little bit of thinking ahead of time, and when you're, you know, in February, when it's not on the top of the list, that's when a little bit of planning can really make a big difference for things. And what are some tips and tricks? What are some things that you advise people to be considering for just such an occasion?
You know, if we have something where we've got to actually get folks out of their house, which, you know, is fairly rare,
right?
It's actually a little bit less rare than you think. It does happen from time to time.
It seems like about every couple of years.
Yeah.
There's something. There's an incident. Yeah.
I'd say that's fair. You know, usually in the Kenai Peninsula, we say, you know, most of the time we're going to say shelter in place. Stay in your home. You know, don't go outside. You know, whatever that happens to be. But, you know, when we're talking about basically probably a trooper or somebody else, a firefighter, knocking on your door and saying, get out now, which we had this year. 2016 was also a great example with the gas explosion in Kenai. That was literally middle of the night. Folks needed to get out, and they were out of there without taking anything. But if it's possible, what we talk about with people to do is have, some people call it a bug out bag. That has a little bit of a connotation to it. But, you know, essentially, can you have in your vehicle, just like you're going to have in the winter, your jumper cables and your hopefully a blanket and some flares and those basic things that I think most of us have, you know, can you have a backpack with some clothes? Can you, if you're able to, can you put medications and things out there? I mean, we know the temperatures are not conducive to having water and food out in our rigs at during the whole year. But
right.
If we have some of those things where we're able to think ahead a little bit and prepare and be able to just jump out of there, can we get our family, can, you know, and that really gets into, you know, what does your family look like? Do you have people with special needs, you know, different access and functional needs? Do you have people that have specific medical requirements, small children, infants? You know everybody's situation is different, but being able to have something that's either in your rig or something you can grab as you're heading out the door to kind of get you through, you know, and they say different things, you know, 3 days is always a good one. But even here, if you even have just 1 day's worth of some supplies and some basics to get you started, I mean, we've seen that when we had like the 2016 event, you know, those folks didn't have anything, much less a wallet or even, you know, day clothes, to be quite honest. So we were able to help them, and there are some mechanisms in place for that. But really thinking about those things, I think a lot of people have the mentality of, you know, I'm just going to stay at home, I'll ride whatever the situation is out. These things don't happen a lot. And I agree with that to an extent. You know, I think most of the time that's the route we go, is simply stay at your home and be prepared at your home. But having some of that ready to go, and maybe having someplace to go, whether that's a friend's house or another family member or a plan, you know, if it's summertime, well, you know, we can grab the camper, we can do all of those types of things, as we've seen. But really thinking that out for your family and thinking about the needs that your family might have that are specialized, like those medical needs, special dietary things, you know, all of that. So just being able to be prepared for that. And of course, what we really would encourage folks to do, especially when we're talking about wildland season, is thinking about some of those techniques like FireWise and some of that what we call mitigation to hopefully prevent this knocking on the door from ever happening in the first place. And there's some places and some ways we can do that, and some ways we know we can't always. So, but it's something definitely for homeowners that are in what we call that wildland-urban interface, that are near the wildland, to be thinking about.
Yeah, one of so many cases where, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, that sort of thing. We're talking about, you know, the idea that there might be a fire and you have to get out. And the next question, of course, is then, well, where do you go? And I wanted to talk about that because You know, in 2014, 2015, I'm thinking of the Cart Street wildfire. The Sterling Community Center became very much precisely that, which it is all the time anyway, but especially during that time, that was absolutely the hub. That was where all the community gathered for information from forestry about the latest developments in the fire. That was where folks were coming in who had literally come in and with, you know, smoke in their hair.
Absolutely.
And the first place to go is the community center. How do you sort of determine where those locations are going to be? I mean, of course, every event is a little bit different, but, you know, community centers around the peninsula, I'm sure all those sorts of places are sort of mapped out as possibilities of where folks can gather and what can serve as sort of a refuge during those times.
They're mapped out as possibilities, and just like you say, people often ask me, you know, where is this location or that location for my community? And my answer always has to be, it depends, because we simply have things that, you know, might cause issues that we originally were thinking about in that particular fire is putting it at the school, which, of course, is right next door to the community center, until we realized we had an incident management team coming in, and we actually needed the internet and the cabling and the rooms more so for that need. So the Sterling Community Center stepped up. There's a couple different iterations of this, and it's interesting that you bring this up because this is actually a concept that we had just tested a couple weeks ago in an exercise, and we're actually formulating a plan. But what we found, so just a little bit of history on this, is the borough or the cities or really anyone else, if there's an evacuation, then we're going to open up a shelter. And that's what we've called it, and that's how we've treated it, where our partners like the American Red Cross will come in, and they're going to have their volunteers, and they'll work 24/7 to provide, you know, a place to be, something to eat, you know, whatever, you know, casework, disaster assistance, whatever that happens to be. So what we observed in 2014, in 2015, and even in 2016 with that gas explosion after the January earthquake, most people do not come to a shelter to actually have overnight sheltering or overnight lodging. It's not the default for most folks. I certainly can understand that because we could go to a hotel, a friend's house, a camp, you know, whatever it happens to be. But what they do is exactly what you said, is they wanted information. They wanted to talk to the officials. They wanted to talk to their neighbors and connect, you know, that social network, that true original social network of person to person. They wanted to, you know, where do I deal with donations? I want to help.
I want to bring stuff in. I want to bring in a plate of cookies and some clothes and
Right. So what we've kind of come up with is we have to adapt to that model. And so we're doing something, for lack of a better word, I don't know if this term is going to stick. We're calling it a disaster help center. And so what this is this is designed to be essentially what's been happening, but in a formalized way of, all right, here we have a place. So pick that as whether it's a school, community center, wherever it happens to be. Here is where we're going to be able to provide anything to you, whether it's snacks or meals, whether it's maybe assistance, you know, so you were evacuated and you don't have your medication or, you know, whatever that is. There's some agencies that can help with that. Whether that's information, let's have community meetings. Let's get the fire officials out there to talk about what the fire is doing. All of that under one place and in kind of a modular way so that we can bring those needs up as they're needed. Because sometimes, you know, we've spent quite a bit of resources getting a shelter set up, which takes time and you've got to tow things out and set things up, and it's not used. So we want to use our folks, because a lot of these folks really are volunteers helping us do this. These aren't employees or professional, you know, firefighters or anything else. We want to do what's going to do most good for the community. And if the community need out there is, I need information or I need assistance, we want to provide that and not a cot in a gym.
That's right.
And so that's the, we're getting towards that concept. So the best way I can answer your original question is, you know, we do have places mapped. We have this first concept that we tested. So some folks may remember we talked about our Alaska Shield exercise in April, and we did some mock evacuations of two neighborhoods in Kenai. Well, the second piece of that was actually running that disaster help center with some help with some volunteer actors, and we were able to start getting some things to put a plan together to do that. So again, it's not a shelter in a different term, but it's really just formalizing and figuring out how we can assist all of these community organizations, and it's leading into another initiative that we're doing called our Whole Community Initiative, which is trying to bring all of those organizations, whether that's a nonprofit group, an NGO, a church, you know, just a group of neighbors, whoever it is, to be able to deal with the volunteers, deal with the donations, because often in these incidents, you know, we certainly appreciate the plate of cookies and the clothes and the food, but, you know, we also have to realize that was the food cooked in a licensed kitchen?
Sure.
You know, all of these things that, you know, we wish we didn't have to think about, but the reality is we do. So how do we, in the Sockeye fire in Mat-Su, they had a Conex, a trailer full of clothing donations. So it would have taken too much manpower to sort through it. Unfortunately, it went to the landfill. So how do we manage those donations? How do we get the word out of what is actually needed, and how do we get that to the right people? And that's what that whole disaster help center concept is.
And, you know, something that I was interested to learn, one of my first go-rounds with one of these things was, again, that community spirit and wanting to help out, and food being such a big part of that. Everyone wants to make sure that everyone's well-fed, and that's fantastic. The teams that come in, you mentioned the incident management teams that come in, it's not just a group of a couple of dozen firefighters with their packs and that's it. I mean, they are coming in and they have semi-trailers full of all their own stuff. They are completely self-sufficient, and it's quite an operation to see those state and federal teams come in and, as I said, completely self-sufficient, and pallets of bottled water, pallets of food ready to go. They have their own kitchen staff. They set up, you know, tents in the on the football field, and they camp out there for the weekend. And so, you know, a lot of these things are already sort of planned for and sort of self-contained in that way.
They are, and they are exactly right. It's the, you know, I laugh at what you can put in a Pelican case, but these guys have it, you know, from big plotters to print maps all the way down to the bottle of waters and the legal pads.
That's
so
right.
They do have all those things, and all of our wildland firefighters are always self-sufficient for 72 hours on their first assignment just by themselves without that apparatus being behind them. So, you know, it's definitely not to say that, you know, we've had some great events showing appreciation for what these men and women do. I mean, and that's not a bad thing, but it does require some coordination and some planning with those folks because they are self-contained. They have their logistical process, and it's a great one. I mean, and some of those big fires, you know, a semi-truck came down from Anchorage every day with supplies that were ordered the previous day. So, you know, those things. So where can we redirect those things? Do we need to redirect that to our neighbors who were evacuated? Do we have a need somewhere else? And again, this is where that management of those things comes into play.
And is that, I have to imagine that's something as an emergency manager that you are continuously refining, revising as a new incident pops up and you see how people react to it and what the needs are for that. That sort of automatically goes into the plan for the next one as a consideration. Might not be used for anything, but it's more knowledge, and it sort of deepens that matrix of what you know how to do and what you know how to handle and what you can anticipate too.
Absolutely. We learn lessons every time we do something. And sometimes we have to relearn lessons a few times over, and we understand that. But, you know, we try and improve, and there's a very formal after-action and improvement process that we go through to make sure we capture those things. And this disaster help center concept I mentioned, you know, even though I kind of alluded to it starting during those wildfires in 2014 and 15, truly that was a direct lesson learned from 2016, was our no-notice, you know, gas explosion in the subdivision here in Kenai. There were a lot of lessons learned from that, and that's where we really started realizing that we provided a shelter, which I'm going to use in quotes here, as in, here's a building, and we eventually got some stuff over there. I'll remind you, it was about 1 o'clock in the morning,
right?
So it took us, again, a little time to ramp up. But, you know, what we had in front of us was we had people that were yanked out of bed. We had small children. People were in their bedclothes. They didn't have anything with them, maybe not even a wallet, like I mentioned before. And really what happened in there, as much as I would like to take credit for it, you know, it was the other organizations, the churches and some of the community members, some of the employers in Kenai. They were the ones stepping up at 4 or 5 in the morning as they heard about this. Of course, pretty much everybody got woke up by that earthquake, if
right.
You'll remember.
Uh-huh.
So word got out quickly, thanks social media and those other things. And all of a sudden, you know, donations started coming in. And all of a sudden, somebody started coming in to help and finding activities for the children. You know, obviously, this is a very traumatic thing. And, you know, I've told this story in a few meetings as we've talked about this concept is, you know, I was the emergency manager. I was thinking about all these different things, or actually I was not the emergency manager at the time. I was still working for the office, but I was assigned to work on this incident. And I went, well, I didn't even think about the children. You know, there's small children. They're confused. You know, they're out of their routine. And so that's really where this came from, is that there's a whole gamut of other needs that really government isn't the best suited to take care of your children. I mean, let's just be honest about that. So how do we leverage that? How do we get those people in? And at the same time, are those people vetted? Do we have trustworthy folks that are there to, for the right reasons? And so all of those considerations come into play. We don't have a perfect system yet, but we do try and learn from everything. And that 2016 event was an eye opener for us.
You're mentioning things that are sort of a level of anticipation for one of these events that I certainly would have never begun to consider. And that's, as you say, that's each one serves as a learning event as well.
Absolutely.
For sure. Dan Nelson joining us this morning on the Kenai Conversation. If you would like to jump in on the conversation, 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. Perhaps you have some tips, tricks, or stories about how you have dealt with one of the Kenai Peninsula's many emergencies that we have to deal with on a fairly regular basis. Of course, right now we're talking about wildland fires and how to sort of stay prepared for those possibilities as we're in the heart of that season, despite the recent weather. Hopefully it'll be drying up, but not too much drying up, just a little bit of drying up. Again, 283-8414 is the number if you'd like to hop in on the conversation this morning. Yeah, I'm curious, in talking about a response to specific areas, some of these things can happen in really far-flung places. How up-to-date is the borough's emergency address system and, having those street numbers out there and street addresses out there so that everything can be, everybody knows where to get to immediately? Is that pretty tough to handle? Because there are, I'm asking this because a little personal story, I had the cabin that I rent is kind of a little bit off the beaten path a little bit. And the person who was coming out to do a little maintenance was new to the area and didn't know exactly where it was. And it took me a second to remember my own street address. And then trying to transmit that to him in a way that made any sense at all was a bit of a struggle. How good of a grasp do we have on just the basic street addresses and maps around here? Because that's, when we think about it, the borough is so young,
Yes.
Yeah.
And we've been working on this for many, many years where, a lot of us used to just have P.O. boxes, especially if we weren't
right.
in the cities.
Right.
And we didn't even have a physical address at our location, And it'd be
right.
kind of down, Smith Way and, third house on the right, those
exactly.
types of things.
Yeah.
So, and that was the way that was. And really, it's been a multi-year process. And I want to say, and I'm guessing just a little bit here, about 15 years ago, this really became a priority for us. And there were a lot of reasons for that. A lot of people started going to cluster boxes and things, addressing was required to get mail. But also, of course, as we realized, as our 911 system got more advanced,
mm-hmm.
We're able to use these technologies now where we can locate addresses and locate where landline phones and things were. And as those things started coming through, what they called enhanced 911, it became important for folks to actually have an address. So I say that the borough has done a great job in getting a lot of those addresses out, and a lot of those areas are addressed, at least if there is some sort of structure
there,
or
yeah.
something on it. There's many lots that don't have a physical address,
mm-hmm.
and this is a very good plug of a time where if you're building or you're developing a new lot, make sure you're giving the borough planning department a call and let them know that you're doing this. And I understand sometimes that might mean the assessor comes out. I get that. But it is important, too, for the emergency services and those things to make sure we can respond. And another really great thing here is make sure you and, especially children and everybody else knows your physical address. You might, not all of us have landline phones anymore. Probably about half of us do in the Kenai Peninsula, we estimate. So whether that's posting that at your phone or, having that and having your children learn that so they can recite it if there's an emergency to a 911 dispatcher. All of those things are important. And then I've got to put in a plug for making sure that your house is marked. And I spent many years volunteering for one of our emergency services here. And it is hard to find a house in the pitch black and the dark,
That's
even
right.
with good directions. So I will say the one service the borough does provide, if you contact the planning department, which or go on our website, you can find a link to it. For $20, they will actually come out and install a reflective address sign and put it out on the road so that fire truck or that ambulance or that police officer can see it. And it's $20 well spent of a great investment that you don't even have to do yourself. And I think they summer is when they usually get those put out, so this is a good time for folks to do it if they don't have it. So I think the addressing is certainly always going to be a work in progress. We do have a lot of duplicate street names. There is some confusion, but they have been working through the years to do that. That's a slow process. It, you know, street names get public hearings, and then when they get changed, and you know, of course, it is just a little bit of government in that. But it really is important because our first responders do their best to know their area. But I'll give an example. You know, our central emergency service area here in the Central Peninsula is over 2,000 square miles. You know, it's a big area, and although we're getting more and more advanced with having maps and in our rigs and everything else, you know, again, technology isn't always perfect. So
well, and again, it might not even be, you know, so much a problem of knowing, you know, where a place is sort of on the borough's map and this sort of thing, but actually, you know, what actual house is this? Yes. We know what street it's on. We know where that street is. That's not the issue, but which house is it? Because we can't tell. Yeah. Because there's three houses and none of them are marked and
yeah, none of them are lit. And, yeah. and that happens. And, you know, especially when we get out into those more rural areas and that's how people want to live and they have a long driveway, which is nothing wrong with that. But if you put that address sign out there up front, we can definitely see that, and knowing where, knowing what our address is and what directions we can give is very important.
We've sort of been skirting around, and I think probably touched on a lot of aspects of it so far. In looking at the borough's OEM website, I came across this notion of community wildfire protection plans, and I again, this kind of gets back to I would guess a lot of the different partnerships, and whether that's with the municipalities within the borough or the nonprofit. And those sorts of organizations around, but maybe you could talk a little bit about that community wildfire protection plan. What does that entail? How does that get updated? Is there a way to offer feedback into such a thing? Yeah.
You know, and I'll be the first to admit that is actually not on the top of things that I deal with, but it is certainly something that I'm involved with and do support. But we have a group of these agencies that we kind of call our All Lands, All Hands group.
Right, yes, and, yes, that was, yeah, part of it, yeah.
Absolutely, and that involves many, many stakeholders, the municipalities like you talked about, but also many of the landowners. So that will include the borough, that will include the Fish and Wildlife, or National Wildlife Refuge, mm-hmm. Chugach National Forest, you know, all of those types of folks, people like CIRI, the native corporations, you know, any major landowners, especially in the wildland, that might have those things. And those community wildfire protection plans are actually in the process of being updated right now. Many of them are fairly aged, and they'll go through a profile of, you know, what are the hazards, you know, what is the profile. And again, I'm not a forester, but we talk about the types of fuels, so the types of trees, the types of vegetation, you know, the profile of an area, whether it's more rural, more urban, and it gives really a tool for us to start planning for that mitigation work. So in 2017, just an example, we had a small fire, and the name of it is so small, this name escapes me right now, but it was one where we didn't end up having to evacuate really folks. It was one we were nervous about, but a fuel break had been put in a few years back as a mitigation project, mm-hmm. against some neighborhoods, and that was extremely successful because there was no homes lost, and the winds cooperated with us, as I recall, and it kind of went out into the wildland.
Right.
But in the year after, we extended that, and that was through those partnerships. So that community wildfire protection plan, I guess the best way for me to describe it is it's a way to formalize those partnerships and to formalize a plan for things that we can potentially do in the future. So maybe if there is some funding opportunity, or those different landowners maybe all contribute to a fuel break or a clearing project. There was just recently one that involved, it was about a $300,000 project, a grant that involved a lot of the state parkland, where they were able to clear a lot of that dead fuel and create, again, some defensible space and those types of things. So that's really the vehicle that we use to do that. And like I say, they are actually all under revision. We started last year, and I think I don't know what the progress is on it. It's a multi-year. It takes a year or two for those plans to go through all the process, because we plan them in you know, based on the geography. So different right. areas of the borough have a different plan because of their different characteristics.
And population probably being just about number one on the list, I would imagine.
Absolutely. And, you know, and just profile, just vegetation and fuels and what kind of trees and how much land and, you know, all of those factors come into play.
Sure. Dan Nelson again joining us this week on the Kenai Conversation. If you'd like to jump in on the conversation, talking a little bit about wildland fire response and what you can do to prepare for such a thing, 283-8414 is the number. Again, 283-8414. And we talked, you know, we talked a little bit about sort of what folks can think about before an event, what to expect sort of during an event potentially. We haven't really talked about what to do sort of after an event, because after a fire goes through, and we've seen this again in recent years as some of these events have occurred, there's, you know, you got to go back home and deal with this. And whether that means that your yard is now covered in red or potentially something worse, there's an after process to this. And I guess I'll let you cover that, because depending on, again, each situation is different, but there are a lot of considerations to make when you're coming back into one of these areas, especially after an evacuation.
Absolutely. So, you know, you might, as you say, the retardant from the airplane right. is coming down and on red, and we certainly saw a lot of that in the 2014 and 2015 fires. So whether that's cleanup for your own personal property, maybe that's some improvement that we need to make for mitigation for mm-hmm. the next time, or if unfortunately maybe some of your lot was burned or affected by the fire. So the top thing that really we want to make sure is we want to make sure people are safe, and we want to make sure your property is safe. So oftentimes what we've done in the past is maybe we've created areas for that dead vegetation that might be on your private property. If that's getting cleared, that people can get that dropped off. Again, we don't want that to burn again. If it right. missed you, we don't want it to burn and flare up. So we try and provide some recovery opportunities for folks to maybe clean up their land, you know, and some of it, you know, red retardant. You flush it a lot with hoses and water. I mean, yeah. it's definitely something, but it's just one of those things where we've got to kind of do the cleanup, get things back to normal. You know, in any disaster, we want to get things back to normal as quickly as possible. That's the whole idea of it. We get people back to work, we get people in their homes, the economy gets back to where it should be, kids are in school, you know, that whole range. So, but there's some occasions where, unfortunately, we do have people that have lost homes, some of them their main homes, some of them maybe recreational homes. And depending on the event and depending on the scope, there may be opportunity for folks to help them get back on their feet with some individual assistance. So, you know, recently, of course, our November 30th earthquake, mm-hmm. there are some people that are taking advantage of some assistance programs. And so that often takes, that just takes some work, and it takes some steps to go through providing quite a bit of paperwork and documentation that that proves that you live there and you're doing all those things. You own the property, whatever your insurance covers if you have it. So there's that step as well, where we'll set up something called a disaster assistance center. Again, so think about the disaster help center now. We're in assistance, which is kind of in that recovery phase, where some of those professionals from the state that administer that program will come in and be able to assist you. So there is that gamut from being able to clean up and just get things back to normal and get our, you know, property back and, you know, all sorts of great things. I loved going through areas and seeing signs thanking the firefighters in those areas. So all of those steps that we've done. But also if unfortunately we do end up on that other spectrum, it's how do we get our house back? What are our temporary options for lodging? And that's, again, something in that disaster help center, that disaster assistance center we try and do. But that, again, is not something we really know the details of until it happens and what the scope is.
Yeah, that's right. And I'm glad you brought up that sort of assistance aspect of it. I'm curious, just, you know, sort of in a broad sense, you know, going back the last few years and some of the bigger events more recently, has the borough sort of facilitated or had to administer a lot of disaster assistance in those terms? I know that as these things come along, there are, you know, public disaster declarations and those sorts of things, but I'm thinking more in terms of property loss and that kind of thing.
So the Borough for Assistance doesn't administer the program directly.
Those are all state and above, right?
Yeah, we support the state and the Fed. Usually, it's usually state for something like a wildfire. It's where we would get a presidential declaration for a wildfire. Could happen, but typically that's the state, and there are some limitations on that where Generally, it's only used for your primary home. So if you know you got your fishing cabin on the river, that's not
qualified.
That's not going
to count. Yeah.
No, but we assist in just being able to make sure we get the word out and that we're able to help people and navigate that process. It is a we're a little bit of government. We do always like our processes, so we do help people navigate that. So the borough doesn't do that, but what the borough does in a lot of occasions is if there is a loss that has rendered your home uninhabitable or something along those lines, you can file a form with us and we help with that, and that'll also take a credit off your property tax assessment. So our assessors will adjust your property tax if you're not able to inhabit it or you've lost some use. So that is a program that we do have available that provides just a bit of assistance for folks when they run into that issue.
Yeah, just one of the many things that folks have to deal with in the aftermath of any disaster, really. I mean, we're kind of focused on wildfires today just because it's that season, but a lot of this stuff is applicable year round for any event that might occur. You know, I wanted to take some time and give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about, because you mentioned it earlier, so many of the folks who help out in a situation like we're talking about today are volunteers, and a lot of them go through training that the borough provides, that CERT training, that community emergency response training. And I'm curious if there are aspects to that are really kind of fire specific or specific to different things, or is it really kind of comprehensive, that training? Talk a little bit about that, maybe.
The training is fairly comprehensive, yeah. Although we certainly take advantage of the seasons to address some of those things.
Okay,
and again, it also depends on where in the peninsula you happen to be, and the risks are certainly different. So, you know, for instance, if you're on the east side near Seward, and there's certainly a wildfire risk, but not as much as some of these other areas. But they have a tsunami risk that the central peninsula does not. So we joke that Alaska is always trying to kill you. So there is different ways to deal with those things and different risks. But community emergency response teams are folks that you might see. They're kind of green is their color. They're in their green vests and helmets. And what these folks are, these are volunteers. They're you and me. We don't want or need people that are first responders. We don't want people that are really trained. It's a training that's designed for the layperson, where we're going to equip you with some tools to respond to a disaster. And the whole impetus for the CERT program has been, all right, we have a disaster. We know our first responders will be overwhelmed with calls. It might be a while before they can get to us. So what do we do and what tools can we teach people? So we'll go through, it's about a 30-hour training course to start, our basic training, where we'll go through some basic things. You know, a lot in the disaster preparedness. We speak for many hours on those steps, but also fire response, medical first aid, you know, some things that are more geared towards disasters than maybe your CPR first aid course that you might take down with somebody. Light search and rescue, how to take care of your neighbors, maybe finding people in an after earthquake where there's been light damage. And then we go into that team organization. We teach about the incident command system, the system we all use because they fit in part of that. And that's where we use our CERT team quite a bit for that volunteer piece. And they're certainly not exclusive to us, but they're really the borough boots on the ground folks. So the borough has a very similar concept to what we described earlier with forestry, where it gets to be a big enough incident, they'll bring in an incident management team. If an incident that we're managing or supporting is bigger than just our office, and my office has four people in it, so it usually gets to this point, we bring in our incident management team. And these are borough employees that have other jobs, whatever it happens to be, but they've volunteered to take the extra training and to keep recurrent so they can do that operational or do those logistics or whatever it is. But, you know, the borough really doesn't have a lot of employees as a whole, and many of those people might be folks that are doing some very important work during disasters. So instead of pulling them from that important work, we have these volunteers because people do want to help. So CERT teams may come in and they may help us answer telephones, for instance. They might do, you know, copying and filing and those things at the office and just help us manage things. But also, they might be manning those checkpoints where there's a map of the wildfire to give information to citizens. They might block off roads or help keep traffic flowing or provide security in an evacuated area in cooperation with law enforcement and doing that door-to-door evacuation. So CERT teams are really what let us do a lot of what we do, because we simply don't have that workforce. So it lets us essentially surge up with people, and they're your neighbors. You know, they're people that we know, and you know, we found that that's been very effective because people want to talk to their neighbors. People trust their neighbors maybe a little bit more than they trust me just sitting here saying something about sure. about a disaster. So it's neighbors helping neighbors. That's what we get to. And we've actually been looking at our CERT program and looking at different ways that we can do different things. But we just recently did our wildfire training, a little refresher on doing these types of evacuations and these notifications just about a month ago, actually, in preparation for this season because... Yep, it is raining out there today, but a few weeks ago was a fairly early start to wildfire season, much earlier than we usually get here on the Kenai Peninsula.
Again, Dan Nelson joining us today on the Kenai Conversation. In talking about those CERT volunteers, the Community Emergency Response Team volunteers, you know, I could do a whole show with someone from you know about. The ways in which you organize volunteers and how you come up with a plan to keep folks busy because so many people do have energy and they do want to help out, but unless they have a specific thing to do, if you're just standing around, that's not really being very helpful. You don't feel like you're doing much. You don't feel like, you know, and that's a really quick way to make sure that your volunteer pool goes down pretty quickly. And so I guess I'd be a little bit curious to know how you've sort of refined your processes and refined things so that when something happens and you make that call and the volunteers come in, they know, do they have like, you know, like a check sheet, here's what you're going to do. How has that been refined so that everybody knows their role all the time and can, you know, basically stay busy and feel helpful?
Absolutely. You know, and I wish I could say refined was the right word for this process. I do joke that sometimes during those wildfires, it was more like show up and somebody will run around looking stressed and hand you an assignment and get you on the road. But, you know, what we try and do, and we are trying to refine this, you know, as much as we can as we go. And this is something that's definitely not perfect yet. But, you know, when we're coming in and let's say we have to do an evacuation or we have to do something, we try as much as we can to give some of that pre-training. So there's some people that have had... you know, specialized training. So, for example, if you're going to answer phones from the public when we have an information line, there's certainly quite a bit of extra training that goes into,
right.
you know, what information, how do you get it, what are those official, again, vetted information that's accurate. And there's folks that have taken, you know, have varying experience levels. So we've been trying to think about how we're doing that, and we're trying to do some new trainings in which to bring that in. You know, we've always had a historic issue with, you know, we might train here in the Central Peninsula, but then we've got to go do the same in the South Peninsula or the East Peninsula and do it several times. And of course, by the time you do that circle, it's time to do another training. But now doing some things with remote delivery, with web video conferencing and things like that, we're able to deliver that. So it's unfortunately not as refined as you think, but that incident command system where we have those identified supervisors, whether that be borough staff or some of the folks that we've trained in CERT, that kind of have that plan, that have that checklist that can then get teams put together. And there's a very, very formal team structure that we follow for, you know, we don't go out alone, we don't do some of these things.
Right.
So that's really how we do it. And we're not any different than any other volunteer organization. I hear quite a bit that, well, you don't call us out enough. Well, okay, I'm sorry. No disasters this week, but we certainly try and do drills and exercises and keep people engaged. And what we've actually been seeing, which is wonderful to see, is a lot more younger people are starting to become involved with our program. I've had several high school students. I think I've got one graduating this year, but several more just took the most recent class. So always a great thing to see the younger folks being active in their community and wanting to help.
Very good. Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, from the individual volunteer's perspective, it's less about, you know, going through some training for a specific job or a specific task and more about being available to handle sort of anything that might be thrown at someone who can just be an extra set of hands, an extra set of eyes, an extra set of ears, an extra voice.
And that's exactly right. And we've gone back and forth on, you know, do we try and get people very, very specific training? Do we maybe revise this basic training that we do? In fact, this summer is a little bit of some work we want to do internally to really vision that out and see if we're still on the right track or if we need to make some modifications coming up for the upcoming year. You know, that I don't know what those that's going to look like quite yet, but that's really what it is. And many of these folks really come to the program because they went through something. After 2014, which many of you will remember, was really the biggest event we'd had in quite a while,
right?
Since then, since maybe even the 2011 tsunami warning that didn't end up being a warning. It had been several years, and if you remember, that was in right over Memorial Day weekend, May and June, that fire happened. And we had actually, which we don't usually do, we put on a class in summer, and it was that class was full. I think I had 30 people in there, and it was all because some people had been turned away at that point as a volunteer because they didn't have any training, they weren't vetted, so we couldn't use them. So that encouraged people to come out. And that, in and of itself, going back to that concept, is also another thing where we know these folks are vetted, that they do have some basic training, and part of that whole community concept I alluded to, which could in and of itself be another show, is how do we manage everybody that wants to come in? Because we don't want to turn people away. It's been something very traditional in emergency management. You know, people like me have been trained of, you know, keep the volunteers away. They're going to hurt themselves. They'll hurt somebody else. But if you look at some of this national news coverage where we've had these hurricanes and police departments are putting out on Twitter, here's the calls. If anybody that has a boat can go get them, go get them. And that's been a real shift in my business from really, you know, leave it to the professionals that I say in air quotes to, really, let's get the whole community involved. And that's what we're really trying to do as our really overarching objective here over the next few years.
And you're absolutely right, and you're giving me an idea. And maybe this will be another hour that we can spend talking about, because you've talked about a couple of times you've mentioned this idea of, you know, vetting people. And so that's a whole process. And then, again, deciding how specialized a training you want to give volunteers, because that's, you know, that's not for nothing. That's a lot of time and effort that goes into training of any sort. And how much do you want to devote to someone who may or may not be around for when you need them and what they're being trained for?
Yeah. There's an absolute fiscal issue. CERT is not a cheap program. We'll put it that way. Once we put in, you know, when we get into staff time and all the training that we do, a lot of times on weekends and evenings is when volunteers can do that. So that's when we're there. But yeah, what is that objective really going to look like, and how do we go through that process? We have it, but do we need to expand it? Do we need to contract it? Do we need to maybe partner with other agencies to help us do some of those things? There's a lot of questions out there.
Well, Dan Nelson, emergency manager for the Kenai Peninsula Borough, we've got, as usual, just a couple minutes left. It's happened so quickly. In that couple minutes, I guess I just leave you with any sort of final thoughts or what folks ought to be thinking about, again, as we're heading into summer and sort of peak wildfire season coming up in the next, you know, several weeks, 6 weeks or so. And hopefully it'll be green and a little bit, that danger will be down a little bit. But
It certainly is greening up, and that's a good thing. And, you know, I like the rain. Just for this purpose, and hopefully again by the weekend it'll be a little bit more pleasant to be out once the work week is over. But, you know, definitely with things, as I encourage folks, especially if you live in a more rural area, is go online. You can go to the borough website, the Office of Emergency Management website, and you can get links to the FireWise program and some of that guidance. But let's make sure that, you know, we can give as much as we can to the effort of making sure we protect our homes, that we protect ourselves, that we're protecting those responders. So whether that's defensible space, whether that's doing a little bit of housekeeping with the dead vegetation, keeping things watered, there's a lot of great guidance out there. We do have some materials at the office. You know, the Division of Forestry is happy to answer questions. I know your local fire department will as well. So there's a lot of folks out here that are ready to help. So I encourage folks in that. Encourage folks to be ready, and definitely, if you haven't already done it, I'll encourage folks, I'm going to give you a website in just a second here, to sign up for KPB Alerts to make sure that you get we've got your landline phone numbers already, but especially if you don't have one, you can put your cell phones in there, you can put the cell phones for everyone in your family, and you can also associate multiple addresses with it. So if you do have multiple properties, that makes sure that we can target you with information. We don't do this very often, it's only for very serious things, but that website is alerts.kpb, like Kenai Peninsula Borough, kpb.us. And that'll lead you through a sign-up process. We only use your number for this. It's a very secure site. So encourage folks to do that. So if there is an evacuation, if there is some sort of notice that we need to give you, we can get you out. And also all of our cities and partners can access it as well. So you'll get information from them. But just be fire wise and be safe and be thinking about those things as you recreate and as we start doing yard work and all those things this summer.
Very good. Dan Nelson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.